Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Richard Ady with you for the next hour. Think about this. You feel a bit odd. You're not worried about it, but it's weird. So after a bit of nagging from your other half, you go to the GP. He says it'll sort itself out. And the next day, you nearly die. You'll meet someone today who, 6 years after this happened, still thinks he's lucky to be alive. He's very funny about it, too. But before we do, the countdown is on. In 48 hours or so, my first guest will be immersed in a hothouse of ideas. Reverend Tim Costello will be in a room in Parliament House in Canberra with 99 other bright sparks trying to solve some of our biggest problems. And of all the topics to be covered at the summit, these issues are closest to our daily life, communities, families, and a newer concept, social inclusion. As chair of this part of the summit, Tim Costello will be using all his leadership skills to get the best out of a very diverse and passionate group of people. And he joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Yeah, thanks, Richard.
You must have an idea of the Australia you'd like to live in the year 2020. What's that vision?
It's a vision that I think is shared by most people in that room. I don't think this will be the hard bit. It says that families are resilient and strong where they have their tragedies and difficulties. There are surrounding communities that also pick up and support those people through tough times. And they're communities that aren't prescriptive and narrow in nature, saying only if you have our religious view or our view of ethnicity do you belong. They're communities that have actually learned to celebrate each other's difference and found strength in that. And really, they're communities that have had the courage to say when it's addictive things such as binge drinking or too much gambling or drugs, when it's issues of mental illness, you can expect us not to have a stigma thrown at someone, but to be in there supporting them because we know that's ultimately how we'll deal with homelessness when we see the streaming of all of these issues together and have a mature response.
Australia's changing rapidly. What do you think are the biggest changes that need the bold new ideas?
Look, I think the biggest changes are getting a sense of story or perspective, if you like. The most difficult thing for me is coming from the worst parts of the world that I visit. And we all live in a bubble, and I come out thinking Australians are going to want to hear about my reality there. Of course, the Australians here in their own bubble say, well, what's the cricket score and the footy score? Not interested. The most difficult thing is coming back and hearing Australians say, oh, it's terrible here, and moan about this society. Now, I think with our social inclusion track, we need to go to say we actually have a fantastic foundation we're building from. We have not just democracy and relatively corruption-free society, but a society where there's universal health, universal education. Every child at least has the chance to reach their full potential. But we know that there are real challenges. Those are locational disadvantage, and this would be my biggest. The postcode where you're born will determine your educational opportunities, your health opportunities, often even when you will die, how many years you'll get. So we need to actually be tackling that and saying in a 2020 Australia, where you're born, which is the great lottery of life in the world, at least if you're born in Australia, you get a chance, unlike if you're born in Mozambique, where you drew last ticket in this great lottery. But even within Australia, there's first and last tickets, and it's by postcode, and that locational disadvantage, I think, is the big challenge.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Tim Costello, who will be chairing the 2020 Summit Session on Communities, Families and Social Inclusion. And he's on countdown now to get ready for a very busy weekend in Canberra. Tim, we live in a very wealthy country. Not everyone shares that wealth, and here at Life Matters, we're getting used to hearing that term, social inclusion. But what does it mean to you?
Well, I really think it means thinking about the mainstream. I mean, my challenge with 100 passionate advocates who come from at least 19 different welfare areas of disadvantage is that they will be arguing on behalf of the 5% that they represent. I think the real question about social inclusion is, what does it mean for the 95%? How do they actually view their fellow Australians, those who are poor, those who sometimes, because of their religion, if they're Muslim, are under suspicion, those who have particular disabilities, and in an Australia that just wants you to be beautiful and young and look terrific, what does this mean? And particularly those who have mental health issues. I think mental health issues are still the huge stigma. Now, the challenge is to say, how do we get the 95% to say they're just as Australian as I am? I will actually know them, support them, celebrate with them as much as I would the people I naturally flock to as birds of a feather who are like me. And changing perceptions of those 95% with some really good ideas, I think, is the challenge.
This weekend you'll be tackling seven questions on everything from families and safety, housing, services, chronic disadvantage. You've already touched on that. It's huge. You're going to get through at least three rolls of butcher's paper, I'm picking. How in such a short time are you going to come up with anything practical?
Well, we've had our 100 applicants put their best ideas, 100 words on the website, so we've got a foundation. We will be saying, look, tear up your Obama-type brilliant speeches. If you've come thinking, and I've done this in the past, if everyone just shut up for long enough and listened to me for long enough, they'd all be convinced of my brilliant idea and say, we're going to work together. We're going to get out your ideas. We're going to get out what you aspire to Australia to be. We're going to get out what are the challenges and blocks to getting there. And then in groups of 10, then groups of 25, then in the plenary of 100, and going in and out of those groups, we're going to actually workshop those ideas. And then we'll have the hard job of actually, you know, we'll have 20, 50, 100 great ideas, sifting them down to 5 to 10, because the government has said, give us 5 or 10. Don't do all the policy work. How can you in a day and a half do all that? The government will do the policy work. They'll look at it and say, well, is it a good idea? What would it cost? Can you really do this? And Kevin Rudd, I think, has said very courageously, even if it's not a Labor Party idea or a platform, if it's a good idea, we'll respond to it seriously.
Hasn't the Prime Minister already jumped the gun for you a bit? Because he overnight announced a new idea for providing families with a one-stop shop for the services they need, everything from newborns up to really school age. It's ambitious. There's no costing on it yet. Aren't you going to have to include that in your 5 to 10?
Look, I just hate it when he steals all their best ideas in our limelight. I think this is what's really interesting. The last 10 or 15 years in Australia, I think, and in other parts of the world, I think we've had very few policy roads for people in community and civil society to actually shape government policy. The theory, you might remember, was that government steers and the rest of society, community groups, row the ship of state. But the person who steers has the ideas. They decide the policies and which direction and which waters we're going to go through. Now, I think what Kevin Rudd has done, which is really interesting, is saying in the 21st century, we're going to allow a whole lot of other voices to give us best ideas, to shape policy, to have access. And what I have discovered, and this is a psychological comment, is that when people have been invited into some of the summits in schools, communities, informal ones I've run, they are incredibly excited about this. They're going, gee, my idea might get a hearing and even reach the government ears. The energy, the thought, the responsibility about this has untapped something in the culture that I think is really fantastic. Now, your question is, is there too many ideas? Has Kevin Rudd preempted us? I actually think the best ideas will still win out because they will be publicly known.
No idea. No guarantees then for the Prime Minister on this one. Fair enough. In the background paper for your part of the summit, I'm sure the summiteers are all studying it as we speak, it talks about the very high numbers of low-income households in Australia. Mm. How possible is it to change this?
Well, there's all sorts of schemes which are different to simply government and private market, but really do belong to the third sector, the third sector being the community. You know, at the end of the day, we live out our lives in families and communities, and a lot of us aren't in for-profit businesses just saying, from a housing point of view, we'll just maximise a dollar. A lot of us aren't in politics. So I think the third sector communities has some real possibilities to introduce a rent-to-buy scheme. So you're in housing that's maybe rental, there should be tax incentives and then community-based incentives to help you buy that place, to help you, if you're young particularly and can't get a deposit together, get access. I think the community sector, properly targeted, can come up with a whole range of supports to make that possible with incentives from both business and government. So those sorts of ideas, I think, will be on the table this weekend.
You mentioned the family briefly. The family remains the anchor point for social engagement, but family forms are changing a lot. I am now part of only 40% of people who live in a traditional nuclear family. Are families best left to get on with it, or do they need more support?
I know, I think we all know that families are really the incubator that shapes our values and our lifestyles. And what we know is the nuclear family was always a little bit of an aberration. From other cultures, from biblical times, there was extended families. And the idea of Hillary Clinton that said it takes a village to raise a child, I think has always been right. I know living in Switzerland with our first child for 2.5 years studying, without uncles, aunts, grandparents, it was incredibly hard. We were, you know, pretty isolated, living an immigrant experience, if you like. So families need to be strengthened, and strengthened in whatever forms they are, to actually deliver the values, the shaping, the care, the love that makes us human. And then communities need to reinforce that. And what this weekend's about is policies that help that. And I think what policies are simply love going public. The love that we all experience in a family, when it goes public, is in hopefully a set of policies that really strengthens what families do best.
Now, the National Alliance Against Alcohol-Related Violence was formed this week. What are your specific ideas for reducing the impact of alcohol in the community?
Well, firstly, we've got to look at supply. When there's been two new licence outlets for the last every day for the last 20 years, do we even wonder why we've got a problem? We know that the concentration of outlets, the late opening hours often to 5 a.m, which is in those streets in my city, Melbourne, and other streets what police call just alcohol-fuelled bedlam, saying they are terrified to go there. We've got to start to cut off supply. So you can stay in a pub after midnight, but you're not going to be served alcohol. You can still party and enjoy yourself. The notion that binge drinkers have is that I want to drink as much as I can, as quickly as I can, as cheaply as I can, to get as smashed as quickly, you know, as possible, has to be challenged. And I think access, supply questions and taxing questions. This is where the federal government could learn from the Northern Territory, where I am today. When they taxed by volume alcohol, high alcohol caskets, port wine, overnight, when they taxed that, assaults started to evaporate in black and white communities. When they lifted that tax because the High Court struck it down, said it was a federal tax, those assaults returned. Now, taxing alcohol by volume, I think, is a really significant way to deal with supply.
But you actually want to change our culture. You're more ambitious than levers like tax. You actually, as I understand it, hope that by 2020, the idea of being intoxicated is just as socially unacceptable as sexual harassment.
Yeah, the National Alcohol Strategy actually says intoxication is never right. We should have a culture where we never believe it's acceptable to be intoxicated. Now, we've got young people understanding that if they're drunk too much, they won't get into a car. Fantastic. But, of course, people will still say, well, let's get smashed and I'll just find a taxi home or a friend who'll drive me home. In fact, we want people to say, no, that's bad too. Getting intoxicated is bad. That's where there is social disruption, when I'm much more vulnerable. 47% of all assaults when people are intoxicated, and victims of assault who are intoxicated are much more likely to be injured. So we know we've got a problem. It's not just a problem, it's actually becoming almost an epidemic. And we know that there are things we can do about it in the culture by saying, you know, you can have fantastic fun with a few drinks. In fact, more fun, and not put yourself and the community at risk. That idea, I hope, will take root.
Just before I let you go, Tim, you mentioned earlier the third sector. In the UK, they have an office of the third sector, and that office of the third sector gets access to the Prime Minister. Would that be something that might be a good idea here?
Funnily enough, that's one of the things I'm recommending. Absolutely. I think what we've recognised is a new deal between the government that steers and the third sector that's meant to row, you know, all those community and other groups that try and deliver services. And I think in recognising that, rather than falling back into the government doing it all, intervening, controlling, saying, and if you advocate you community groups, you're going to lose your funding, what we need is a peak body that does really represent so many of those services that make our communities what they are. By the way, volunteerism's on the rise. There is some really optimistic things happening in this third sector. So a peak body that actually formalises it with access to the Prime Minister is overdue.
Well, good luck with it, Tim. Good luck this weekend. Get some sleep now, because I don't think...
Thank you.
And we'll be keen to see what you and the other summiters come up with, and that's the Reverend Tim Costello, who's Chair of the Communities, Families and Social Inclusion part of the 2020 Summit in Canberra this weekend. Later on Life Matters, a guide to surviving the summit. The drama, the passion, the information overload and the box breakfasts. Our reporter, Kerry Ross, will be giving us the gen on that. But still to come today, we'll meet a man forced to laugh at his failing body. Next on Life Matters, better matching migrant skills to the jobs that are available.
On his new double CD, James Brown's sax player Maceo Parker realizes two dreams: to record with a big band and to do a tribute to Ray Charles. Here he does Hallelujah, I Love Her So, and he sings pretty well too. It's our feature disc on the Daily Planet, which is on afternoons right here on ABC Radio National at 2:20 and evenings at 11:20.
What do you think is the most ethnically diverse city in the world? New York? London? Melbourne? How about Toronto? Half the people who live there were born outside Canada, and more than 150 languages are spoken every day. But the city on the shore of Lake Ontario is so successful at attracting immigrants that engineers and doctors really are driving cabs. And this is despite the Greater Toronto Region having big skill shortages, which means both the immigrants and the city itself have been losing out. Well, one organisation's working to square that circle, the Toronto Region Immigrant Employment Council, or TREAC. Its executive director is Elizabeth McIsaac, and she joins me now. Hello.
Good morning.
How many people are we talking about, Elizabeth, in terms of new arrivals every year?
Toronto receives at least 100,000 people every year. Some years we've hit about 120,000, but on average we get about 100,000.
And where are they coming from?
They're coming from all over the world, but our key source countries include India, China, the Philippines and Pakistan.
I've been to Toronto. It's some time ago, but I remember big Chinese, Indian, Ukrainian, Italian, Jamaican communities, among others.
Absolutely.
And the region, I mentioned you have skill shortages, but how pressing are those problems?
Well, it varies from sector to sector. In some areas, especially, for example, in the skilled trades, there are severe shortages where the average age of a sheet metal worker is in, you know, between 55 and 60. And then in particular sectors, there's growth, and so we are experiencing shortages. Some of the sort of talk about skill shortages is also a projection of looking out in the next 5 to 10 years as we sort of crunch the numbers on our demographics and look at where the skill shortages may emerge.
Right. And what does that tell you? Are you basically dependent on immigrants?
We are. The stats tell us that by 2011, we're going to be 100% dependent on immigration for net labour market growth. Now, that's a Canada-wide statistic. In Toronto, the City of Toronto, the Economic Development Department there, tells us that we're already at 100%. So it's how we're growing our city, it's how we're growing our economy.
All right. Well, and I suppose another reason to address this, because you've basically now made the economic or business case, is that if you have different communities feeling relatively disadvantaged, and that's what happens when you get immigrant communities in a country, they take a while to catch up, you can get problems with social cohesion.
Absolutely, and particularly where we are deliberately recruiting people with high levels of education. And it's important to note that in Canada, in the last 10 years, the profile of the immigrant is more educated than it ever has been before. And so that we're seeing levels of more than 40% of all immigrants, averaged across children, refugees, everyone, having a post-secondary educational certificate.
And
degree.
These are people coming to settle. They're not coming in for a few years on a special visa. They're coming to make Canada their home.
Of those who are coming to make Canada their home, who are permanent residents, yes. And so that is a real promise that we're holding out to immigrants. And so that really sort of begs the question of fulfilling the promise on the other end once they arrive.
All right. So there's lots of reasons to sort this out, if you like. What do you do?
Well, our organization is really a group of leaders from a number of different sectors that came together about 4 years ago and said, this is an issue that is impacting the vibrancy and prosperity of the city, and what we need to do is find solutions to correct what we are seeing as a labor market failure. And that is because we're seeing, as you opened by saying, we do have, in fact, a severe problem of underemployment, of engineers or doctors driving taxi cabs or doing other jobs that don't reflect their skill level. And so this council, the Toronto Region Immigrant Employment Council, was really brought together to correct that labour market failure and figure out how to make this work better.
All right. Well, what sort of programs do you run to address this?
Well, right from the beginning, we knew that one of the big challenges is that many employers will say to immigrants, do you have Canadian work experience? And to immigrants, this is sort of the elusive requirement. How do you get Canadian labor market experience if you can't get your first job? And so we started a program. We worked with an organization that was already doing internships, and we worked with them to develop an internship specifically for a mature professional. And we called it Career Bridge, and it would be 4 to 12 months, and they would get that work experience. They would be paid while they did it. The employer would pay. And what we have found is incredible results. 85% of the people who have come through that are now working in their field, which is a huge outcome.
What sort of numbers have you put through it?
To date, we've only had about 600 go through. So in a city that receives 100,000 people a year, we have a lot of growth to do in that regard. But I think what's interesting is that the government hasn't paid for it. So companies like Procter & Gamble, our big banks, and other sort of large employers in the region have come on board to participate in this. And so I think the task now is to grow their commitment to it. And they are growing it because part of what they're learning in the process is they're hiring people out of this and they're realizing they didn't need the internship.
What about, I understand also that you do something with mentors. How does that work?
Well, the mentoring thing came out of sort of understanding that when two people get together and when they sort of meet in a relationship and they are occupational or professional peers, really good outcomes can happen. And we saw programs that were happening in the community that had really great success levels. And so the challenge was, how do we create this opportunity for building social capital, for building these networks that make a difference for new immigrants? Because when a new immigrant comes here, they don't have their 20 years of professional networks. In fact, they have very little in terms of social capital. And so we match people up. And it's a volunteer program among Canadian professionals who sign up. They get matched over a four-month period with a newly arrived immigrant. And they meet for about an hour a week, and they give advice. They help sort of shed light on how to do a job search in that field here in Toronto.
And how effective is that?
We've had some great results, and sort of anecdotally, there's stories of sort of young professionals who have signed up as volunteer mentors, and there was one from a consulting firm, in fact, and she was a 28-year-old professional, had finished her MBA and was a consultant. She got matched with a fellow who was 20 years her senior, much more experienced, and she was sort of hesitant to take it on. And someone, one of the senior partners in the firm, said to her, well, no, go ahead. You've just done your job search. That's the wisdom that you can sort of share with him and help him along with. It turned out he ended up finding a job and actually finding a job that was going to pay about $40,000 more a year than she was making. So it was a great story of she really just helped him understand how to open the doors to opportunity.
And, of course, you get a ripple effect, don't you, for everyone who acts as a mentor, because they're going to be more likely to be positive about hiring immigrants. They're going to be more likely to do it themselves, and they're going to be more likely to be evangelistic about this within their workplace.
Well, in fact, we just completed an evaluation of the program, and this is one of the big findings that we came across. And it's that, the figure was 95% of the people who have gone through as mentors in the survey, they reported that they are more likely now to hire a skilled immigrant themselves or refer one to one of their professional colleagues. And so that's a tremendous outcome, particularly when we know that one of the big challenges of immigrants getting their first job is someone being afraid of taking that risk. And so we're sort of increasingly creating this group of people who have participated in the program who understand that their counterparts from other countries have so much to offer the workplace. And to date, we've put through about 3,000 matches. So that's a lot of champions out there.
On Life Matters today, my guest today is Elizabeth McIsaac. She's Executive Director of the Toronto Region Immigrant Employment Council, which I guess is a bit of a mouthful when she's at parties. This is an organisation that got going a few years ago because Toronto gets 100,000 immigrants a year. The total immigration to Australia this financial year is around 150,000, and Toronto, the city and region, realised it really wasn't making the most out of these people and that it would be better for everyone if they were employed at their level of their talents and qualifications, and the Toronto Region Immigrant Council is the result of that. Elizabeth, you also have a website, I think it's Hire Immigrants. What does that do?
That's an initiative that's really targeted at the other side of the equation. On the one hand, you have immigrants who are looking for jobs. The other side is where the jobs lie, the employers. And so our thinking on that was we wanted to build the employer's capacity to do a better job of recruiting, retaining, and promoting skilled immigrants in their workplace. So hireimmigrants.ca is a website that provides kind of an online learning community for HR professionals and employers of different sizes and gives them tools and resources and even ways of connecting with one another to increase their capacity to do this better.
What about the issues of, qualifications or certification? Because one of the reasons why you end up with doctors from, I don't know, Belarusia driving cabs is that they've got the pieces of paper, but the pieces of paper don't mean the same thing in Canada. How are you looking at that?
Well, in the province of Ontario, where Toronto is, we have recently passed legislation that has appointed what is called a Fairness Commissioner. And this office is really in charge of now asking the different occupational and professional regulatory bodies to be accountable to this office, to provide annual audits and to be transparent in the processes which they undertake to evaluate, assess, and license internationally trained professionals. In our work, we're watching what's happening there because it's relatively new, and then we're trying to figure out, is there a way that we can leverage our council membership, which includes employers and government and colleges and universities, to help that process become more transparent and more accountable?
Because some of the highly certified professions, they wouldn't put it this way, but they have been guilty of trying to maintain a closed shop, and this happens everywhere.
Absolutely, and they also have the public trust and the requirement to protect the public good. And so it's trying to find a balance between what is a reasonable expectation and requirement in order to allow someone to practice.
What about something more long-term? Going to culture in the end, like trying to convince the human resources people in the region or talking to business schools?
Well, some of the work that we're doing on that, and this is related back to the website, thehireimmigrants.ca, we've begun talking to some of the business schools here in Toronto, and we're developing sort of the Harvard case study type model of looking at this as a lens through which HR managers, as they come up through the system, that there is curriculum that will, going forward, begin to guide how they understand their profession and practice their profession. So we're really trying to create almost a knowledge base of the literature and practice around inclusion of immigrants.
And an awareness from day one, if you like.
Exactly.
Now, Toronto isn't the only place facing these kind of issues. Have other cities been knocking on your door?
They have. In fact, there's a city in your neighborhood, Auckland, New Zealand, has recently launched a similar type council. It's called Omega. And they are setting out to do exactly the same thing, to become a city that is more inclusive and welcoming of immigrants. And I think increasingly, and certainly across Canada, we're beginning to see the replication of this model in other cities. But increasingly among OECD countries, we're going to see an interest and appetite for this, because all of what these countries share in common is a demographic pressure and labor market pressure that's going to drive them to be looking to bring in international talent. And then that has challenges around recognition and inclusion.
What are your long-term plans for the organization, Elizabeth?
I think ultimately what we would like to see happen is we'd like to see the corporate community own and run this issue as their own, because this is really helping them to see it in their own best interest, sort of an enlightened self-interest, if you will, so that they see that this is what is going to bring productivity, vitality, and innovation to their business, while at the same time creating a more fair, accessible environment for new immigrants to the country.
You'd go out of business then, of course.
Ideally, I should be out of a job.
Well, good luck with that. Perhaps not just yet. And thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth McIsaac's in charge of the Toronto Region Immigrant Employment Council, which is still a fairly new organisation, which didn't come directly out of government at all. It came out of really a group of leaders across different sectors in that city. You can find out more about it at our website. And I'll just remind you of that. It's abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It'll make a good story later. I think that whenever something bad is happening, I thought it the first time I missed a plane, and every time since. I thought it the other night, when the simple act of taking my son to a football match turned into a 7-hour epic. But touch wood, I haven't thought it while lying in intensive care with tubes in places I would rather there aren't tubes. My next guest has. He went to the doctor on Wednesday in November 2001, and his life hasn't been the same since. Nigel Smith is a TV writer and producer. He's written a funny and at times very confronting book about what happened to him, and he joins me now from the UK. Nigel, welcome to Life Matters. What took you into the doctor that day, the doctor who incidentally looked uncannily like Colonel Sanders?
Yeah, he looked like Colonel Sanders, and he had about as much desire of keeping me alive as Colonel Sanders did to his chickens, I think, really. And I had a kind of thing where I had this numbness in the left side of my tongue, the left side of my hand, and left on my left foot. Now, to you and me and everybody else, that means I've been lying funny. To a doctor, it should mean this man's got a serious neurological problem, get him to help quickly. And he just kind of fobbed me off, and he said it was probably fine. And I rang up my friend, who was another doctor called Phil Hammond, who I think you might know over there. He's half an Aussie himself, Phil. He's a doctor. I was writing a show with him at the time, bizarrely, about the hospital. I rang him. I said, Phil, mate, I said, I've got these symptoms. I've seen a doctor. I don't really believe him. You know, what do you think? So I told him the symptoms, and there was a pause. So I said, what do you think, mate? He said, you tell me the truth. I went, yeah. He said, well, if you tell me the truth, you're buggered, mate, which I thought was a bit full on. And so I ignored him for the simple reason it might be serious. And then the next day, the wife kind of said, look, you're really poorly. I'm dizzy and sick. But then, you know, I've been a TV producer and I've been dizzy and sick quite a lot, really.
Yeah.
You know, especially at Edinburgh festivals. So, you know, I kind of used to it. Anyway, so a few hours later, there I was. I had a brain scan. And the first amusing thing happened where the radiologist came out of the little room and said to the doctor, said, right, where's the body? So I kind of gathered from that it wasn't going to be good news.
What was wrong with you?
It's a viral infection of some kind, which I think is modern medicine's way of saying evil spirits got you on a Tuesday. Something made the white cells attack each other in the base of my brain, the medulla. And the medulla is like the signal box of the brain. So all your kind of normal thoughts, or in my case, my very abnormal thoughts, were completely fine. But kind of translating it into action, you know, wasn't really happening. And so, and this lesion, which is kind of like a kind of big cyst in a way, was just getting bigger and bigger, and less information was going from the brain to my body. So bits of my body just stopped working. And I had my Nigel Not Dead 6 last year. You know, we sort of kept drunk, really. And I just, it's a chance to remember how great life is, you know. I mean, even though I'm not quite the bloke I was, it felt better being here than anywhere else I've heard of.
Yes. This all came at a time when you had a lot to look forward to, didn't it?
Kind of a bummer, really, but I think it would help pull me through. I'd inherited a couple of kids from the wife, which is brilliant, but she just announced one day, kind of casually, like women do, that that she was with child, and the father, yeah, he was me. Well, she says that, you know, I kind of believe her. She's actually just kicking me now because she's sitting next to me. And she was about 3 months gone when I was almost gone, and through my illness. I mean, she was enormous. I mean, she's quite a small woman.
This is Michelle, and she was actually really important because she was your big advocate. At one stage, she managed to get a Nobel Prize winner.
This is my wife. My wife is an extraordinary and wonderful woman, which I would say even if I wasn't sitting next to her, but her feet in a very precarious position. And one night, I think things were quite grim, and so she needed a sort of second or third opinion. So it's quite a long story short. She managed to borrow the notes from the hospital, all the scans, and she convinced this eminent brain surgeon, a man called Dr. Patrick Kelly in New York, to stop over on his way to Stockholm to pick up some prize from the Nobel Institute you might have heard of, and look at my scans by the light of the Avis rent-a-car desk, because that was the best light there was.
This is it.
And so there she was at 4 a.m, bearding this poor bloke off the plane. He had to look at my scans. And the great thing was, he said, look, A, it's not a tumour, which was the kind of prevailing medical thought. And B, even if it is a tumour, it is operable.
Now, the book is not for those who are offended by strong language.
It's for everybody. The book is for everyone, especially children.
Especially at
Christmas. I think every school should buy one for their library now.
And it's
I've got 15,000 in the garage, it's fine.
Yeah, well, you can use them as loft insulation, I suppose, if things don't work out.
The loft's been done. The garage is a problem now.
So there's a bit of language. And look, if you're squeamish about no-holds-barred descriptions of bodily malfunctions, hold back.
I mean, there's two reasons for this. One is that I think bodily functions are funny. I'm English, that's what we do. But also, there's a kind of a serious point to the kind of the knockabout stuff. Is that when you go to hospital, and it will happen to you at some point, unless you are really lucky or, you know, really unlucky, you are going to lose your dignity at some point. We're just machines. The machines made of flesh and blood and some smelly stuff, and they will probably go wrong at some point. Now, it can be a very disorientating and very undignified process, being ill, and people trying to make you better. You're going to have to get used to that, and you will leak, and you will be in pain, and things will happen to you. We often don't talk about these things and pretend it doesn't happen, but it will happen. And I think you have to hold on to what is the essential you within this. Now, with me, it was being really rude and angry and trying to have a sense of humour about it. Now, dignity doesn't just mean walking around with a, you know, with a kind of, with your nose stuck up in the air. Dignity is just holding on to who you are. You know, it's just holding on to what you think you are, why you're worth living, why you're worth saving.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Nigel Smith, who's a comedy writer, a TV writer and producer, who went through something astonishing and terrible in 2001, 2002, and has written about it. I think there's something wrong with me, a comedy trauma, it's called. That's what we're talking about. Most books about life-threatening illnesses, people who come through them, well, they tend to say, my doctors and nurses were wonderful and fabulous, yeah, godlike people. Now, you don't do that.
Credit where credit's due. I mean, I do make great things about the people who were marvellous to me, and I wouldn't be here if there weren't a team of people. On the other hand, in any organisation, I don't care what organisation it is, even in broadcasting, there are people who really shouldn't be there. There are people I came into contact with in my months in hospital and months in rehab outside hospital that weren't very nice. And there's no point pretending they were. They weren't. They're horrible.
There's a doctor called Doris, and she's the one who cut your throat when you need a trachea to help you to breathe.
We love Doris.
You want to understand her, but you find her very difficult to get close to.
Doris I met for the first time post my illness last year at one of my Nigel's Not Dead parties in November. And I couldn't believe her. She was lively and vivacious and just like Martina Navratilova, like a female version. And she was great. I mean, she was just fun and lively and wonderful. And the Doris I remember was kind of, you know, always in scrubs or, you know, gowned up and, you know, has quite a strong German accent. Quite austere, but always told the truth and was very caring. And let's face it, she just cut my throat, you know. I mean, I was never going to be that warm to her. But she was a marvel. You know, very few things went wrong on her watch. And bearing in mind I was in intensive care for 3 months, that's a lot of hours for things to go wrong. Because things do change from day to day and from hour to hour when you're in intensive care.
You spent quite a bit of time there, and then you spent a lot of time in rehabilitation.
When you're on intensive care with 9 machines and a team of doctors ignoring you, helping you, and you focused really just simply on just not dying from day to day. But then when you start to stop dying and you start to try and climb back up the mountain to being well, and I'll tell you something else as well, the National Health Service is a fantastic place to stop you dying. It's not brilliant at helping you live. So the rehabilitation from a kind of a quadriplegic to a bloke who kind of walks around now, generally unaided, walking into the odd wall occasionally with a stick. Learning how to be disabled, learning how to live as a disabled man with all the problems I had and still have, that's a whole different process. And the place I was sent to was not a particularly nice place. And they got me to walk again pretty much, which I'm very grateful for. I wasn't able to see Michelle because she was having difficulty with the baby at the time, so I got very few visits. It was a very, very grim place. And I was having to come to terms with what life might be like as Stephen Hawking's poorlier brother, you know. I mean, really that poorly. I was basically told by one doctor, unquote, he told me to go home and watch telly and be grateful that you're still here. I went home and wrote some telly because, you know,
that's what you do.
That's pretty much all I can do. I mean, if I was a lumberjack, I'd be really stuffed, you know, but unfortunately, I was, you know, I wrote jokes.
So by the time you got home, you actually had a lot of anger.
Yeah, I was furious. I was livid. I was absolutely, I mean, you know, I was 36, 37 years old. You know, I got lovely kids and, you know, more than one nice pair of trousers, and I got a car. And, you know, I'd done all right for myself, thank you very much. And suddenly, it was all almost taken away from me. The person I thought I was completely stripped away, and I was left in a wheelchair, hardly able to talk. All my left side was paralysed, double vision, sort of, now what? So, yeah, I was angry is the least of it. That's a small word. Is there a bigger word?
No, you've explained it pretty well, I think.
I think if it goes inward, you're in trouble. I think if it turns to bitterness, you are in real trouble. I think you need to find a way to express it and to articulate it. I was fortunate to have that kind of outlook, I suppose. And the family around me to let me. They allowed me to be horrible and to shout and yell and be awful. I mean, I hate to say look at the funny side, but I find the funny side in things. Whether people find what I do funny is another matter and up for debate, and debating quite often, but I find a lot of things funny that perhaps I shouldn't. And so I can't switch that off when it happens to me.
How are things now? Because it's, you know, as you said, it's 6 years, more than 6 years since it all first kicked off.
Yeah, it's 6 years, 3 months, 20 days. Germany's great. And I'm here, the family's well, touch wood. I'm working, and my health's okay. You know, I'm walking around, I have some residual problems. I still eat via tube in my stomach, which is great for as a party trick.
What about going to the pub? Do you go to the pub via a tube?
I go to the pub and just, I still have the odd bevy. Yeah. I just can't swallow it. But you get it in. I inject myself with scotch.
Right.
So I get drunk very quickly.
I'll bet.
And I'm a cheap date. You always forget, you know, your old life because you make of it what you are. And I'd rather it hadn't happened. More for my family than for me. I've dealt with it. You know, I think my family find it difficult. If my kids are ill, I'm distraught. You know, it's like, you know,
yes.
Get a splinter in their fingers. Oh, God, their fingers are splinter. Oh, God, you know, I forgive you for keeping the lights on night and playing your PlayStation 24 hours a day, you know. Please let me splinter not be, make your fingers drop off. I mean, it's terrible. If it happens to you, you can kind of cope with it better.
Nigel Smith, thank you. And I think there's something wrong with me, a comedy trauma, is published by Bantam. Look, you've just heard Nigel's experiences of hospital. What about yours? We want to hear from you on this, but don't call now. Wait until tomorrow. That's when we're looking at what it's like to be in hospital on our Friday talkback. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National with me, Richard Addy.
Hi there, it's Geraldine Doogue here. This week's Saturday Extra contributes to the whole 2020 summit process with the question, how do you turn great ideas into action? We're talking to four can-do Australians who've already pioneered interesting projects which break new ground in building communities, creating healthier water, properly making friendships in our region, and in building better cities. So the future in action now. Saturday Extra, 7:30 till 9, here on ABC Radio National.
There's no doubt that planning the 2020 summit has involved organisational skills of the highest order. Because of this, we at Life Matters have no doubt that practical side of things will go really well. The timing, room allocation, distribution of name tags, catering, it'll be A-grade, all of it. But there is one possibility that can't be planned for. Life Matters is a G-rated program, perhaps PG sometimes. We're not M and we're certainly not R. So I want to be a bit careful here. But there's going to be a heady mix. Big brains, the power of ideas, the cut and thrust of heated debate. We can't know where it will end. Kerry Jean Ross filed this exclusive report.
While commentators, politicians and participants are keen to publicly promote the 2020 summit as an intense and historic harvesting of ideas, Australia's peak psychological body is on high alert for very different reasons. For if ideas, as we're continually told, are indeed very sexy, the summit will shape not only the future of our nation, but also the immediate intimate relationships of the chosen 1,000. President of the Australian Psychological Society, Amanda Gordon.
There's absolutely no doubt that there are people who find ideas the sexiest thing in the world. In fact, they can be the erotic part of their lives. People who use their brains a great deal. Those people are exactly the people who are going to be at this summit.
And the dangers do not stop there. Even a cursory glance at the list of summiteers confirms the majority are middle-aged. Amanda Gordon warns that they are the most vulnerable to ego-flattering advances of a sexual nature.
Look, there is actually a concern that it's the middle-aged people who are going to be the group that are going to this summit, who are going to be rather susceptible to the flattery of other people really enjoying their ideas and getting a bit turned on by them.
So what should summiteers do if they find themselves unable to concentrate on matters of border security? Instead, their emotions are a roller coaster of desire and guilt caused by, for example, the sexy summiteer arguing passionately against that old chestnut, budget surpluses.
We do warn people against panicking if all of these emotions seem to overwhelm them slightly. They have to focus carefully on the words that are being said. And it's very important to use the normal ways of talking yourself down from excitement in order to focus properly on the cognitive ideas that are there. We do want passion. Passion's a very important part of this summit. And passion will lead to great ideas. But we don't want that passion to explode into other areas of people's lives.
But while panic may be subdued, Amanda Gordon also counsels that even our best and brightest live in the real world, a capitalist world racked by infidelity, illicit behaviours and the quest for instant gratification. She says that some attendees who succumb to their worldly appetites may have some tough decisions to make.
The world of the summit is a rarefied world that will last only for a weekend, and people are going to have to move back to their real lives where ideas may be more mundane and where from time to time they have to plod along with the ordinary among us who are not in that rarefied atmosphere. So beware of the headiness of those days in Canberra and remember that real life is full of ordinary feelings and thoughts as well.
In the meantime, the Australian Psychological Society will have extra helplines available from 7:30 on Monday. Amanda Gordon says that guilty summiteers wanting to talk through their weekend behavioural patterns need not be ashamed.
Australian psychologists are aware that we're all human and we get turned on by a variety of triggers, and for those summiteers it's highly likely to have been ideas. If they come away from the summit feeling distressed about their behaviour that's been propelled by the excitement of the ideas, psychologists will be available, although, of course, it will be at the expense of the summiteers and not of the government's budget.
Amanda Gordon, President of the Australian Psychological Society, ending that special 2020 summit report by Kerry Jean Ross. Yesterday in Life Matters, we heard a very powerful, moving documentary about grandmothers, more grandmothers than grandparents generally, who are raising their own grandchildren. Here's an email from Sherry, who's doing just that. I was moved to tears whilst listening to today's story on Life Matters regarding grandparents raising their grandchildren. My husband and I have raised our now five-year-old grandson since he was 2 weeks old, as his mother suffers from a mental illness. Whilst we love our grandson dearly and he brings great joy to our lives, raising him has changed our lives entirely. My 60-year-old husband has returned to work full-time as our savings are now depleted by the additional costs. Our life as a couple has changed, and we're often isolated, not quite fitting in with the young parents at school, and not being able to join friends of our own age for travel or dinner, etc., due to financial and babysitting restrictions. We also provide support to our elderly mothers and our daughter, who often requires treatment for her illness. All of this leaves little time for us as a couple. It is certainly not the golden retirement years that we had planned. Our greatest concern, however, is what happens to our grandson if something happens to either of us. He's already been through so much in his short life and will need support and guidance through his teenage years. Thank you so much for your program. It was so helpful to hear other women that are facing the same issues as we are. We so often feel isolated and exhausted by the day-to-day role that we undertake. And that was from Sherry in response to yesterday's CBC documentary on grandparents as being parents. Now, we also talked recently on the show about Lost Boys with Sam DeBrito. These are men who haven't grown up beyond adolescence. Here's a call on that.
Oh, hi. Look, I only caught the tail end of your conversation with the author of The Lost Boys. I have two sons, and I probably would say that they both fit into the category, and I wholeheartedly agree that once they don't become so self-absorbed and start to think about others around them, that they do become adults. But it takes a while, and in the end you see those lovely boys turn into lovely men. Thanks. Bye.
And thanks for your calls and responses to what we do. We really appreciate it. I want to tell you about some new things to listen to on the Life Matters website. You can hear an extended interview with the future Governor-General, Quentin Bryce, talking about how she's managed work and family over the years. There's a new edition of EdPod too, all about bringing history to life in the classroom. So go to abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters and you can find out all about that. Now, coming up next on ABC Radio National, right after the news, is The Book Show. And Ramona Koval is here to tell us what she's got.
Well, I've got Lewis Lapham on the program with Lapham's Quarterly, the second in the series, all about money. And I love this. This is for people who don't have enough time to read everything in history that they should have read. And Lewis Lapham has collected all kinds of people together about money. And I'll also be having a look at a fascinating central Italian village discovery of a 17th century library. Isn't that exciting?
It does sound fantastic. Did you get to
it's
go?
It's a fantastic show.
Did you get to go to the Italian library?
I didn't, but with the power of satellites, we get to speak to people who did.
Join Ramona straight after the news for that. Now, tomorrow on Life Matters, it's our Friday talk back. It's about being a patient. Hospital admissions are going up every year, and there's a lot of focus on giving patients a better hospital experience. But what's stayed with you from your time? Give us a ring.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.